So should we start with like maybe getting to know what are asset managers, who are these asset managers? Can we start from there? Is that a good place to start?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very good place to start. So, asset, I mean, in their essence, asset management is a very straightforward business. I mean, it comes in many different shapes and sizes, and that's where some of the complexity comes in. But at its heart, it's a very straightforward thing. So all an asset manager is a company that carries out investment principally on behalf of others. So they take money from others, and those others can either be institutions like pension schemes or insurance companies or banks, for example, or they can be ordinary households, ordinary individual investors like you or I. So they take money from those third parties and they invest that money on their behalf with a view to generating positive returns for those clients. And in return for that, they charge fees for doing so. So that's basically the business model is investing principally others' money and generating fees for carrying out that service. And I say principally, they do in most cases invest some of their own money alongside that of their clients, but generally speaking, that's only a very small proportion of the money they invest. So most of it is investing other people's money.
So when we talk about asset managers, like at least for me, like as an average person, I just feel like my mind quickly goes to like BlackRock or like these very huge asset management funds. I think they have like trillions of dollars in management.
They do indeed.
Is that like the is that the majority? Like, are there like very like where I'm trying to get that is also like, I feel like people who invest in like asset management funds are also like very huge institutional investors. Like when I see the assets that they have in management, it's like so huge, right? It doesn't feel like I will get to invest in BlackRock or I will get to like so is that fair where you know where it's dominated by kind of like very large players and you don't have like small players in this game, or is that like a misperception and there are actually very small players as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of questions bound up in one there. So I'll try and kind of disaggregate it a little bit. I mean, so on the one side, you're right that most of the money that is being managed and invested by asset management firms is money that is committed to their funds by institutions, by big institutional investors. However, a lot of the money that will be invested, say BlackRock, that they're taking from institutional investors is ultimately money that belongs to you or I. By which I mean principally pension fund money, so retirement savings. But obviously a lot of that money, that retirement wealth that is being invested is aggregated by pension schemes. So you and I don't necessarily have a direct relationship with BlackRock, but our money is invested with BlackRock through the scheme that manages our pension. So that's the first thing to say. Second thing to say is that the asset management world is indeed substantially dominated by big institutions like BlackRock. So I think the latest data I've seen is that asset managers collectively managed around $100 trillion in total assets. So that means that collectively they've been given $100 trillion to invest for their clients. And I think BlackRock has about 10% of that, about 10 trillion. So which is a pretty big share of a and then the other two kind of really big ones, State Street and Vanguard, probably have, I don't know, maybe 8, 7 trillion $25 each. So between the three of the big three players have about $25 trillion or about a 25% market share. So I think it's broadly right that and understandable that those are the types of companies that most people have heard of when they think about asset management. Now, I think the only other thing I would say in to answer to that is that, and this goes back to where I started in terms of kind of where some of the complexity comes in. So the asset management world is still substantially dominated by what I would call mainstream asset management. And what I mean by mainstream asset management is where the money that asset managers are taking from their clients is being invested in mainstream asset classes, by which I mean publicly listed shares and bonds. So essentially that money is being invested in the stock market or in the bond market, which are public facing, very liquid, enormous markets. And so a big proportion of the asset management business represents investment in those publicly listed securities, publicly listed equities and bonds. And that's the business that's dominated by BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, Fidelity, and a few others. But the thing that's been, you know, arguably the most significant trend in asset management over the past 30 or 40 years has been diversification away from those traditional asset classes. So increasingly, asset managers have taken the money that they're given by their clients and invested that money not only in those traditional asset classes, but also put it in things like real estate and in infrastructure and in privately owned equity, as in private equity, and other so-called alternative asset classes. And so today, maybe, I don't know, 15 to 20% of all the money managed by asset managers is put into alternative asset classes rather than those mainstream asset classes of publicly listed equities and bonds. Does that make sense?
I think so. So in the sense, like I have a few comments here in the sense. So even though like initially when I mentioned that I may not be able to, like, it doesn't seem like an individual will be able to, like, you know, go to BlackRock and give them money to invest. But it seems like implicitly everybody is involved, like when you mentioned the case of like pension funds. So even though I may not be directly involved with BlackRock, but by paying my pension, and if my pension fund is kind of in talks or is working with BlackRock, then I'm implicitly involved. So that's,
yes.
I mean, in that sense, like, I feel like a lot of the population or a lot of people, even though they may not be directly in touch with BlackRock or they may not even know what BlackRock is, will be kind of under the purview of what of the work that BlackRock or these other asset management.
100% correct. I mean, in fact, I'd say two or three things in answer to that. Absolutely, that's true. And in fact, I would say pretty much anyone who has a pension that is managed by a pension fund trustee has some money being invested through an asset management like BlackRock, because most pension schemes today use asset managers to carry out some or even all of their investment. There are some pension schemes that still do most of their investing themselves, but for the most part, they use asset managers and pay them fees for doing that. So that's the first thing I'd say. So absolutely right. Secondly, you or I, as a kind of very small individual investor, certainly can establish a direct relationship with a BlackRock or a Fidelity. You can open an investment account and you only have to put in maybe a couple of $1,000s or something, and you can put it into a fund that BlackRock runs that invests in global equities, for example. What you can't do, though, if you are someone such as you or I, is give money to BlackRock and put it into one of its funds that invests in private equity or in real estate or in infrastructure, those alternative asset classes. Because the funds that they establish to invest in those alternative assets, they often will have a minimum investment requirement, which might be, like $20 million. So in those cases, absolutely, you can't have a direct relationship with BlackRock. You can only, as an individual, you can only, with only a small amount of capital to invest, you can only invest in their kind of mainstream funds, not in their alternative funds.
Also, so the size of these funds is ridiculously large, right? I mean, the assets under management of BlackRock, I think, is about $10 trillion.
Correct.
Yeah. Last I checked, India's GDP was about, I think, $3.5 trillion.
Yeah.
So they manage more money than some of the world's largest countries.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Huge amounts of money. Yeah, huge amounts of money.
Also, I don't feel like, I mean, so there is this company called, Renaissance Hedge Fund. So when people talk about that fund, I think they have like two funds, which is like one is a Medallion fund, and I think there's another fund as well. When you talk about these kind of hedge funds, there seems to be a lot of complicated things going on. Like, you know, they seem to be using like not only things under the hood, but also the kind of things that they invest in apparently is very complicated. I've heard, I don't know. With these people, I mean, with the BlackRock or these asset managers, it seems like they're not doing anything complicated per se, right? Like in the sense when you mentioned they're just investing in public assets, either publicly listed equities or one is a publicly listed equity. So nothing complicated seems to be going on here. It's not like they are like swapping derivatives or some other like very heavy financial engineering that's been going on. Is that fair to say, or am I missing something there?
So how is it best to approach this question? So let's go back to where I was. So if asset managers that have all sorts of different strategies and vehicles whereby they invest. And much of what they do is indeed very straightforward. They are investing in publicly listed equities or bonds in the hope that the price of those products, those financial assets, will go up, and therefore that they're making a profit for their investors and earning fees for doing that. Now, one thing that asset managers can do is they can establish certain types of fund that have more sophisticated investment strategies. And when people hear the word hedge fund, that typically means a fund that has been established by an asset manager, its strategies for investing are more complicated than that very simple investment strategy that I just described. So, for example, one thing that hedge funds can do is they can make investments that will generate a profit for them if the price of the thing that they're buying goes down, which is what's called short selling. So most investment funds established by asset managers don't do that, and indeed can't do that. You have to have special licenses to do that. So all a hedge fund is a particular type of investment fund established by an asset manager that has a more sophisticated investment strategy, such as so-called short selling, being able to generate a profit from falling market prices rather than rising market prices. And that's all a hedge fund is. But I guess the key point I would make is that a hedge fund manager is nonetheless still an asset manager. It's just that a hedge fund is a particular variant of investment fund established by asset management companies rather than a particular type of company itself. That's what the way I would put it.
Fair enough. I'm trying to understand, like, what is the why do these asset managers or why do these companies exist in the first place? So I think you alluded to the question, like, I think you alluded earlier that, you know, obviously to make money, in the sense like when they buy equities or when they buy public equities, the motivation is to like maybe buy them at cheap and on a future date maybe sell them at a higher price. At the end of the day, it's just to make money. Is that fair? Am I getting, is that as simple as that? Or is that a complicated story or any other?
No, it's absolutely as simple as that. But the basic reason why they exist is because many of the people in the institutions who hold capital, who hold money available for investment, are not or do not see themselves as financially sophisticated, financially literate, financially capable individuals or institutions. And so they therefore use quote unquote experts to carry out that investment for them. So that's why asset managers exist. And that's what, you know, that's how they justify themselves, right? Is they say, well, look, we will carry out your investment for you because we're experts at that. We have experience at doing that. We have the resources necessary to enable us to do the research to figure out what's going to be a good investment and what isn't. And therefore, it's worth your while paying us, you know, whatever the percentage is, 0.5% or 0.2% of your money that you want to invest to carry out that investment for you. Because in the long run, you'll make more money by giving us the job of doing it than if you try and do it yourselves, given that you are not a particularly financially sophisticated investor. So that's the whole reason why it exists in the first place. And they've been very, very successful at persuading not just the likes of you and I, but persuading, you know, the trustees of big pension funds that they can do a better job of investing than those individuals can themselves. So that's why it exists.
And the people who have invested in these funds, in these asset managers, I'm sure they must have done really well, right? I mean, I think the performance of these of this industry, I'm assuming is they have done extremely well.
Well,
financial performance wise,
I think that it depends on who you read. It depends on who you listen to. It depends on how you measure things. And it depends on what type of asset class you're talking about that they're investing in.
I'm really sorry. So you seem to be hesitating in the sense that, so it's not clear cut yes or no that they have an, so the way I'm thinking about this is like, so again, as an average outsider, when I look at like Berkshire Hathaway or like the company that Warren Buffett runs, I feel like it's been extremely successful. Like I think no matter who you ask, they will not say like, you know, depends which year. I think broadly they'll just say, you know, Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett has done extremely well over the long run. But with this, you seem to be hesitating by which I feel like they have not done as well as maybe I'm thinking they have. Is that fair? Or
I think that is fair. I mean, take something like a company like BlackRock, or you could take Berkshire Hathaway. I think the answer is always it depends. It depends on when you have given your money to that manager to invest. I mean, if you give them the money at the beginning of a 10-year bull market, when markets in general are rising over that period, then sure, almost certainly you're going to do very well, because it's pretty hard to lose money in a rising bull market for 10 years. But if you give them that money to invest at the beginning of a bear market, then almost likely you're not going to do very well. It also depends on what type of investment fund the money is invested into. Some investment funds perform much better than others, and that would be as true of different funds established by Berkshire Hathaway as it would be for any other asset manager. So I think the answer is always it depends on who the asset manager is, when you're investing with them, and what type of investment fund or funds you're putting the money into. So if you give money to BlackRock, for example, as an individual investor or as an institutional investor, you don't just say to BlackRock, here's the money, invest it. You put it into a particular fund that is managed by BlackRock. That fund might invest in global equities. It might invest in commercial real estate. It might invest in energy infrastructure. And of course, the performance of the particular fund will dictate how well you do out of that investment.
I think partly why I was kind of getting there is because that the scale that they're operating in, when you talk about like assets under management of on the order of $10 trillion, I mean, that is only achievable if you're able to produce like very good results, right? Like, I mean,
absolutely,
I'm sure like any company or any firm, any asset manager per se will start, everybody starts small, right? Like it's very rare that somebody gets to manage $1 billion the day that the company is born.
What I would say about that is it's not coincidental that the biggest part of the business of the biggest asset managers like BlackRock and like Vanguard is what's called passive investment. It's investment in what are called index funds, where the actual asset manager itself doesn't play a very active role. All those funds do is track the performance of publicly listed market indices like the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Index or whatever. And those funds charge very, very, very low fees. And those passive funds have become essentially the cheapest way for investors to access investment in the stock market at large. And they've done very, very well, precisely because those index funds typically perform better than more actively managed funds. And so in a sense, the most successful asset managers, measured by the amount of capital they have under management, are precisely those that actually perform a very, very passive role. There's a kind of irony there, that the biggest asset managers are the least active in terms of, you know, making choices about what to invest in, because their biggest funds are those that are index funds that simply track the performance of major market indices.
So, the more there is human intervention, the risky the performance you might get. Like, I mean, it's best that the human does not touch or go near that fund. It's best to kind of...
I wouldn't say that. What I would say, though, is that the more there is human deliberation going on in terms of actual selection of investments, the greater variability there is in performance. So there will be some asset managers, or at least for a short period of time, outperform those general market indices, but there'll also be many, even including many with very good reputations who have done well historically, who will do very poorly. And there is a long-standing debate about whether it's even worth investing in those actively managed funds. There's lots of people that would argue that in the long run, you're better off just putting money into those index funds. I don't have a particular view on that debate, but that's an ongoing and kind of eternal debate.
Any theories or is it just that the pension funds like to invest in these kind of companies, or is there any reason why so first of all, let me take a step back in the sense, pension funds dominate the capital that is allocated to these asset managers? If so, like any reason for that, or is it just like convenience? Why is it just easy for them to even, is that?
They do. So historically, the answer to your question is yes. So that historically, pension funds have been the biggest contributors of capital to these funds managed by asset managers. And there's a simple reason for that, which is that historically, the bulk of the what you might call the surplus capital that is held globally, by which I mean capital that's available for long-term investment, has been the capital of held in pension funds. So that's where the capital is. But increasingly, that's not so clear. So increasingly, for example, sovereign wealth funds, so the sovereign wealth funds of countries like Saudi Arabia, or the sovereign wealth funds of Kuwait or of Singapore.
I'm so sorry, but can you maybe tell us what is a sovereign wealth fund?
So sovereign wealth fund is an investment fund that is managed by and controlled by a sovereign nation. So the government of a country like Saudi Arabia or Norway. So for example, Norway has a huge sovereign wealth fund that represents the capital of the government, because the government has been very, very successful in building up huge surpluses of capital through the taxation of the oil and gas industry in Norway. And the same applies in Saudi Arabia. So it's government capital, essentially, that's being invested. And as they've built up more and more money for investment, they've become increasingly important contributors of capital to asset managers' funds. So more and more of the capital that is invested by asset managers today is the capital of sovereign wealth funds rather than pension funds. But pension funds remain very, very, very important. But I mean, the question of why they use asset managers rather than doing it themselves is that they think that they're going to do better by giving the money to a selection of asset managers than spending the time and spending the money to establish a significant internal team of investment managers themselves. So, for example, if you are the trustee of a pension fund, and you will have a choice. You could be like, well, either I can give 20% of the money to BlackRock, 20% to KKR, 20% to Blackstone, whatever. Or you can say, okay, we're not going to do any of that, but I'm going to recruit 20 investment professionals myself who are going to carry out all that investment. Well, most people take the first decision. They think that it's worth paying those fees for external experts to do it rather than building up an internal team and therefore paying through the salaries of those staff to carry out that investment.
So you touched on this again earlier when you spoke about for these kind of funds, generally there is some requirement that they themselves have to put in. Let's say if the fund is of $10 million, the managers will have to put up, I don't know, $1 million or $500,000 or $2 million each per se. Is there any like specific requirement? Like, I think I was talking to a VC yesterday and she was telling me how, at least in India, so you have to have, you need to have like a minimum of 1.5 crores. I don't know how much that is in dollars, but some amount of, like, let's consider $500,000 minimum of capital that has to be put in by the GP or by the investor. Yeah. So is there any requirements like that? And like also related to that, like I'm trying to understand the incentives of, are the incentives aligned of the investor managers that, you know, if the fund does well, they will also do well? Or are there any misaligned incentives going on there?
Yeah, those are all really good questions. So my understanding is that in most places, there has not been a legal requirement for the asset manager itself to put money into the fund. So for example, let me see if I can think of a good example. So there's a UK asset management company called Innisfree, which historically has been the most important asset manager in the UK for investment in public private partnerships in the health and education sectors. And until relatively recently, it didn't put any of its own money into the funds that it established to invest in that type of infrastructure. It does now, but it didn't historically. So in most places, there has not been a requirement. However, most asset managers have generally put money into the funds that they establish to invest in things like real estate and in infrastructure and things like that. And the reason they've done that goes precisely to your second question, which is that they would argue, at least, that in doing that, they are effectively aligning their incentives with those of their clients. They say, look, you can trust us to do our best to generate good returns for this fund, because look, some of the money in this fund is our own. So naturally, we are going to do everything in our power to make sure that this fund performs as well as possible, because some of the money in it is our own. But of course, there's another way in which they align those incentives, which is that they can charge fees to their clients that are based on the performance of that fund. So again, if we go back to something we were talking about earlier, the huge funds managed by the likes of BlackRock and Vanguard that are index funds that merely track the performance of indices, those types of funds do not charge performance fees. So the only fee they charge is a management fee, which is a very small percentage of the money that a particular client has invested in that fund. Somewhere around 0.1 or 0.15% normally would be a standard rate for those types of funds. But the more active a manager is in managing the fund, in kind of researching and carrying out and making selections for where it's going to invest, the higher the management fee they will charge, because there's more work being undertaken in managing that fund and in carrying out the investment. And also, the more likely it is that they will charge performance fees. And if you have a fund that is like a private equity fund or a hedge fund or a real estate fund or an infrastructure fund, the asset manager will almost always charge a performance fee as well as the aforementioned management fee. And that performance fee almost always will be calculated as a percentage of any profit that the asset manager generates for the client. So if they make a profit of say $10 million for the client through the investment of the client's capital in that fund, they will charge say 15% or 20% of that profit as a performance fee. And again, that shows that their incentives are aligned. They want the fund to perform well, because the better the fund performs, the better the asset management performs as well.
So just to make sure I understood that, and also to just drill down on like individual incentives, like in the sense, I think till now we were broadly speaking about like Blackstone, Vanguard, and these huge companies as a whole. But like for a manager per se who might be working in these funds or in general in this industry, the way they end up making money is either through performance fees, which is like a percentage cut from the profits,
yep,
and / management fees, which is correct, a very small percentage in the management.
Some of the money that is invested in a real estate fund will be the asset manager's own money, and what I mean by that is two things. So it can be, what it will typically be is some of the money both of the company, say Blackstone's money, corporate capital, but also the money of the specific individual person or people who manages that fund. They will also often put some of their own capital into that fund as well. And so if that fund performs very well, they make money because they've put their own money in. They make money through, and then they make money because of the management fees and performance fees that Blackstone is charging to the clients as well.
Again, as an outsider, I feel like having your money in the fund that you operate, I feel that is like the gold standard. Like people can sell how much ever they want. Like, you know, when it comes to like investing and like, people can sell you like this security is good and this stock is good, but the ultimate question I feel is like, are you invested or no? Like, that is the ultimate gold standard. Like, if you're selling me this thing, and if you're not invested and you're doing something else, that is a huge red flag. At least on a day-to-day basis when you interact with people. And again, going back to Berkshire Hathaway, I think Warren Buffett is like completely invested in Berkshire, and that is like a confidence for the other investors as well, because if the ship goes down, I'm sure that Warren also is dead. So that gives me a sense of comfort that, you know, if everybody goes bankrupt, that Warren is not there, you know, enjoying his retirement with my money or something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I totally understand that sentiment. The only thing I would say is that is two things. So one I would say is that it's important to be cognizant of the kind of proportions involved. So as I said, a typical real estate or infrastructure or private equity fund, on average, only about 2% of the capital invested by that fund is put into the fund by the asset management firm and its professionals. So it's typically a very small amount. And what that means is if the fund performs really badly, if it loses money, then let's be clear, the vast majority of the money that is lost is not the asset manager's own. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that is that the management fees, particularly on funds like real estate and infrastructure funds, that which are the fees that the asset manager earns irrespective of how the fund performs, which on a real estate or infrastructure fund will typically be somewhere between 1.5 to 2% per annum of the committed capital. Those fees mean that the asset manager will typically do pretty well, even if the fund performs very, very badly. So the asset manager is going to end up still making a profit on that fund, even if the fund itself is a failure, because of those guaranteed management fees that it will receive every year of the fund's life.
You did also say that the percentage of the management fees are extremely small, like, I don't know, 1.5% or 0.5%.
On the big index funds managed by the likes of BlackRock and Vanguard, yes, 0.1% or 0.15%. But on actively managed real estate and infrastructure and private equity funds, it's 10 times that. So it's 1.5 to 2% per annum. So those are very, very significant fees. So on those types of funds, the asset manager is pretty well insulated from risk, because they're going to do reasonably well, however well the fund performs, because they're guaranteed to do so by virtue of those guaranteed management fees.
So let me push back a little bit on this, in the sense that, so I'm not really convinced with the fact that that the asset manager. So first of all, I feel that the 2% or the 1 point. So the 2%, if we can round the figure up to 2% management fees. So that also the depend. I feel the amount that the person gets to take home depends on how large the fund is. Also, like how large the fund is. Like if it's obviously a large fund that he's managing or he or she's managing, then obviously he gets to take a lot of money home as management fees. But I would probably make the argument, or I would assume that management fees may not be like a big chunk of the income that he or she's expecting to make. And like maybe, and also as a career incentive, I feel you would have to, like, you cannot cruise on, like if your fund doesn't do well, you may, for this fund, like you may be, your performance might be okay, but you may not get future opportunities to manage funds because of this fund not doing really well. So I feel your career incentives are pretty aligned there.
No, I think those are fair points. So look, the way I often try to explain this to people, and I think it's a good way of looking at it, is to say that you know, we often hear about bankers receiving, you know, big bonuses and so on. What I would say is that for an asset manager, an individual asset manager, it's a good way of thinking about it is to think about management fees as essentially paying their base salary and performance fees as essentially paying their bonus. So if they manage a fund that and that's their main fund they manage for 2 or 3 years, and if that fund doesn't perform well, if that fund even loses money, then they're still going to earn their basic salary every year, no problem, because that's being supported by the management fees. But they won't own bonus. They won't earn bonuses for 2 or 3 years, which, as you say, from a career perspective, could be quite negative. From their career perspective, it might mean that, you know, they haven't been able to have the holidays they wanted for those couple of years. They haven't been able to kind of, you know, trade up in the housing market for a couple of years. But they're still earning, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of basic salary every year. And that's, I guess that's what I'm saying, is that the risk is concentrated elsewhere. The risk that they run is not really the risk of losing money. The risk that they run is perhaps if they continually manage funds that underperform, the risk they run is they might lose their job eventually, or they won't be particularly well positioned to move into a better paying job elsewhere. So it's different types of risk, but the risk of losing a lot of money is risk that is principally borne by the clients of asset managers rather than asset managers themselves. That's all I'm saying.
do you consider, so I feel like for you in your mind, the asset classes of, or when asset managers deal with the public equities is a very different beast than when they deal with real estate or infrastructure project. Is that fair to say? Or
yeah, I think that is fair to say. And I mean, I guess I would put it in a couple of different ways. I think it's different. I mean, it's obviously different. In the sense that you're buying something, in the one case, you're buying what is very clearly just a financial asset. It's kind of a piece of paper, or it's a number on a screen. That's what a financial asset is in the case of a publicly listed security. Whereas if you're buying an apartment block, or you're buying an electricity transmission grid, or you're buying a water supply system, you're buying a very kind of physical, real asset that requires something very different of its owner and its controller than a financial asset does. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing I think that's different.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So if we can just stay here for a second. Let me see if I understood that, because let me try to give you an example so that even in my mind, this is clear. Because I'm not very convinced with the example, with the deviation, with the distinction that you put up. So if we look at a company, let's say I buy an Apple stock. I buy an Apple stock, and I mean, Apple owns, Apple produces phones, and it has like retail stores and other devices that it produces. I buy a stock and I get a piece of paper. But if I buy, so I may not be involved. Also on the management side, I'm not involved in the management. I don't know what products they might come up with, and I have no say in that. So that is one picture. Second picture is if I'm involved in, let's say, if I'm invested in a real estate, even there it's the same, right? Like, I mean, I may not, like me and my friends might be invested in it, and I may not have like say on what to do with, like whether to build a mall there or whether to build a school there. But there might be some guy who will be running the play, who will be managing that real estate, and he will take decision whether to either build an apartment complex or. So in that sense, like broadly, I feel both of them, you know, will have managers and will have business people or will have executives who will take decisions on what to do with that property. Is this fair, or am I missing something which is very?
Well, I guess that comes down to the thing I was going to say. The second part of my answer was going to be that it all really depends on the extent of the investment. And so, what I mean by that is that if you buy a stock in Apple and you own, or you buy lots of stocks in Apple and you own, you know, 0.00001%. of Apple, then of course you have no meaningful role in the running of that company and what it does, and you have no meaningful way of exerting any influence on management. That's absolutely true, of course. If you buy the same proportion of the equity in a company that happens to own and manage apartment blocks. But I guess what I was talking about when I was talking about real estate and infrastructure funds are funds that actually buy the apartment blocks or actually buy the water supply system. So I'm talking about funds that are not buying small numbers of shares in companies that do those things. I'm talking about funds that actually buy the physical assets directly, because then the asset manager and the investment fund that it operates become the owners and managers of those assets. And that requires something very, very different of the asset manager than when they become very small minority shareholders in publicly listed equities. And this is true also in the case of private equity. So private equity investments typically involve the acquisition of controlling shares, so more than 50% of the shares in the company. And that means that the asset manager controls the company. So it ultimately is the one that is making the decisions about what the company does, you know, how many widgets it builds each year and where it sells them and so on. So I'm interested particularly in those cases where the asset manager is taking a very significant controlling interest in things like real estate and infrastructure. And that's a very different business from what the likes of Vanguard and State Street do, which is take passive shareholdings in tens of thousands of different companies.
So I'm still a little confused here in the sense like, so where I'm with you is you seem to suggest that there is a fundamental difference between owning or like having passive involvement in certain companies or in equities per se, and then there's a difference when you're holding like a majority control of real estate or infrastructure projects.
Yes.
I'm there with you. So I feel like we're on the same page there. What I'm getting from that is like, there seem to be some like mismanagement in the sense that the skills that are required to manage these real estate or infrastructure projects are maybe different than what the skill set of the asset manager are. Is that fair or am I missing something?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say, I mean, a couple of things is worth saying about that. Where that's the case, different asset managers tend to have different strategies for how actively they become involved in the day-to-day management of those assets. So some of them, and I think Macquarie, the Australian asset manager, would be a good example of this. A lot of the people that it's a very, very significant actor in the infrastructure investment space. And a lot of the people it has hired over the past two or three decades, during which time it's built up that business, have been people that come from the infrastructure world, who know that world and have existed in that world, and who therefore have a degree of experience and competence when it comes to managing those assets. Whereas other asset managers are, as I think you were kind of hinting at, are finance people. That finance is what they do, and they may still take these controlling interests in physical assets, but they will not handle the day-to-day management of those things themselves. They will, you know, for example, if they're buying an apartment block, they will outsource the kind of relationships with tenants, the collecting of the rent, the physical maintenance of the properties to others. But because they own the assets, it's ultimately they who are making the big strategic decisions about things like rent increases and those sorts of things in a way that they absolutely don't and can't do when they are small minority shareholders with kind of passive shareholdings via index funds. Does that help clarify things a little bit?
I think so.
I totally, your question was a very, very good one. And I totally see where you're coming from with that.
I mean, I'm a little slow while understanding a few things.
No, you're definitely not.
A few points on that one. Till now, what you've mentioned, I think we'll get to the mismanagement part, and I want to probably understand what are the repercussions of this as well, I'm not sure if we've touched on those properly. But if I can take a step back, feel like what these people are doing is till now, I feel like it's pretty fair in the sense that these asset managers are supposed to maximize the shareholder value, or these asset managers are supposed to make the highest amount of returns for their investors. And if that is like, and if the way they do that is by buying up property and increasing the rents, that is in their purview to do so. And I feel like they are well within their rights to do it because they are answerable to someone else. And if I'm running a fund and if I'm not giving proper returns, then I may be out of a job and that is a risk for me. So I will try to do as much as possible to squeeze in the most amount of returns. Is that a fair way to think about it? Am I missing something here?
No, I think that is a fair way to think about it. And I think that, I think that's part of the problem as far as I see it, is that they are under a fiduciary duty to do that. And I think therefore that my argument would be to come at it from the other end of the spectrum, which is to say that insofar as that that's their responsibility to do that, that's why I question whether investment funds managed by asset managers like Blackstone or Macquarie or Brookfield or whoever it might be are actually appropriate owners of those types of assets in the first place, precisely because that's their responsibility to maximize the amount of income they can extract from those assets. And sure, I mean, you might want to come back to this, and sure, other types of private sector actors who own assets like housing or infrastructure may also be profit maximizing entities that are interested first and foremost in generating profits from that activity. But my sense, based on the research that I've done, is that asset managers are somewhat more, need to choose my words carefully, somewhat more kind of ruthless and relentless in that profit extraction business. They're better at it, I guess. One way of putting at it, than other types of private sector actor. And I think that that comes back to some of the things we've been talking about earlier about the particular types of kind of incentive structures that are embedded in the model, the particular fee structures, the fund structures, and things like that. But your basic point is a fair one. It's not one I would disagree with. I don't think that I would push back on that particular point.
When I'm listening to the argument, I feel this is a cautionary tale where I feel like you know, in due course, measures should be either some regulation or some. Someone needs to probably oversee this business, and I feel like I'm getting a sense where, you know, this is not probably the best way to do things. One way this has come up is by when you earlier spoke about rent increases when mm-hmm. they buy properties and either apartment complexes, and then there is a significant increase in rent. Maybe are there other repercussions of this model, or is it mostly? Either in housing rent increases or just real estate prices go significantly up, or am I missing some other repercussions which may be more dangerous or more severe?
Well, I think you see it on both sides of the profit and loss account is the way I will put it. So, if you are an asset manager that manages an investment fund that invests either in housing or in, say, water supply infrastructures, your imperative is to maximize the cash flow that asset is generating, and that means two things. It means maximizing the revenues, and it means minimizing the costs. And so, again, go back to the apartment block as an example. You maximize the revenues by putting up the rents as aggressively as you can, while being careful not to have any negative impact on occupancy. You obviously don't want to push up the rent so fast that people vacate the premises and no one can afford the rent. You want to push up the rent the maximum amount you can without hitting occupancy rates. You don't want vacancies to go up. But on the other hand, you want to minimize the amount of cost that you incur in managing that property, and that can be the cost of paying people to collect rents, the cost of paying people to go around and fix leaks, the cost of paying people to go around and put on a new roof on the property, and so on. And so I would say that from the tenant perspective, which I would say is the perspective I'm kind of most interested in, because those are the people living in the property, that there are those twin sets of dangers, one being the cost that the tenant incurs in renting the property, the second being the quality of the experience, which can be impacted by landlords, for example, not being as good at maintaining the property as you might want them to be if you're a tenant in those properties. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I think one thing that people need to, that it's very important to understand about asset managers, particularly when it comes to investment in housing and infrastructure, is that the types of investment funds that they typically establish to undertake those investments tend to be relatively short-lived vehicles. So they tend to be funds that have a fixed life that of maybe say 10 years. And what that means is that if clients like pension funds and insurance companies are putting money into that fund, that they will get that money back at the end of 10 years. And what that means is if the asset manager is investing by buying apartment blocks, well, long before the 10 years are up, it has to have sold all those apartment blocks so that it can return all of the original capital to the investors, preferably with a nice fat profit having been generated in the process. And that means one thing more than anything else. It means that in those cases, and this is the majority of cases, most of the funds they do this through are of this type. Where that's the case, the asset manager is buying and selling. The asset manager is not buying stuff with a view to remaining invested in it and potentially holding it for a long time or even into perpetuity. The asset manager knows when buying it that he or she will be selling it and has to sell it relatively soon thereafter. And I think, and I would argue, that introduces certain sets of skewed incentives. It means that you will push up the rent particularly aggressively because your interest is in maximizing the value of that asset to other potential buyers. You want other buyers to look at that asset and see that it's generating lots and lots of income. And you also want other potential buyers to look at that asset and see that it's not costing a huge amount of money to maintain that asset. So you are not interested in carrying out, for example, retrofits or maintenance or upgrades of those assets that might generate long-term benefits, because you know that you're not going to be around in 10 years time, let alone 20 years time, to realize the benefits of those investments. You're much more likely to want to carry out relatively superficial fixes that don't cost much and that might solve the problem in the short term, whether that problem is a leaking pipe or whatever else it might be, than to really undertake proper investment for the long term. And that's because of the inherent short-termism of the model. So that's what that, and I can see you're looking skeptical. So I'm waiting to see what you push back with. But my research suggests that's absolutely the case.
Again, I'm so sorry. I feel like I'm going in circles, and do let me know if I am. Like when I think about this, intuitively, I feel like even though it's a 10-year period, I feel for a real estate project, like if I'm investing in a project for 10 years, I know that the project has to be the state of the project or the state of the apartment complex or whatever the real estate infrastructure has to be much better in 10 years than what it is today. Like sorry for the apartment complex example again and again, but let me just stick to that. So if I find an apartment complex today and if I buy it in 2020 and I know that in 2030 I'm going to sell it, like intuitively I would feel like the apartment complex has to be so much better in 2030 that I will, for me to make money at that point in time. Like if the apartment complex is like, if the paint is run down, if the services don't work, if the park is not good, or if there is no parking, and if I've just let the apartment complex to rot, then like I can year on year, I can just continue to collect taxes, continue to collect rents. But at the end of the 10 years, like the apartment complex would be so much worse than what I found that the value of the total asset would have decreased. So I feel like my incentives are so much aligned to not only upkeep the project very well, but also to either upgrade it to a much better state than what it is today. So, but like But as I said, this is what I'm thinking intuitively. And if your research suggests otherwise, then maybe...
I totally hear what you're saying. But I would push back in two ways against that. The first is one where is a way in which I think I've already sort of alluded to, which is yes, you want it to look good. You want it to look, all other things being equal, you want it to look better. You want it to look, but those fixes that you are interested in, you are only interested in fixes that have potential market value within that relatively short time frame that you're being invested. And you can, and those fixes can be relatively superficial in a way that you wouldn't undertake if you thought there was a possibility of remaining invested for the longer term. So that's the first thing I say. The second thing I would say is that by their own admission, many asset managers who invest in housing invest in areas where there are supply shortages, but precisely because they want to be investing in areas where by its very nature it's difficult for tenants to find alternative accommodation. They want to invest in situations where they have market power, you know, for many different reasons. But one of those different reasons is precisely because it allows them to continue to put up rents and to continue to maintain high occupancy levels, even if they're perhaps not doing as good a job on the maintenance front as they might otherwise be doing. And actually, you know, you can listen to some of the interviews they give, and what they will say is that not only are they not particularly interested in contributing to new supply of rental property, they take it as a signal to sell when they see new supply coming on stream in an area, because that might potentially have a negative impact on their market power within that area. So I think it's very, very important to be aware of that. They're savvy, they have very specific geographical strategies about where they invest, which is all about trying to establish market power. Even though when they talk to the press and they talk to the politicians, they say, oh no, we don't have market power, you know, we merely follow the market, you know, we have no power to set rents, the rents we set are those that are established by the market. When they talk to their investors, those that are buying shares in them, they tell a very, very different story. And they actually explain quite clearly about how it is that they establish their investment strategy. So I think those are the two things I would say there. But I mean, I think absolutely right. Intuitively, I hear where you're coming from, but my feeling is that doesn't quite match the reality.
Yeah, I mean, in absence of competition, I'm sure like anything goes, in the sense like the whole idea, at least I feel like the whole idea is like, when you have alternatives, you are able to like negotiate prices, or you like if you're being treated bad by like a provider, then if you have some alternatives, you can go to somebody else or negotiate for prices. But if there is monopoly in terms of like if there is monopoly in the service or the product that they're selling, then right, very difficult to do anything.
Yeah, correct. And it's that's an interesting point, because when people like myself make criticisms of landlords, such as institutional asset manager landlords, for some of the reasons that we do, one of the things they come back with is they'll say, well, you know, across the US, for example, corporate institutional landlords only own, say, 8 or 9% of all rental housing in the US. And the point is that, well, that might be true at a national level, but it's hugely varied geographically. So there'll be some large parts of the country where they don't own any, and then there'll be particular hotspots where they own, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50%. And so they have, and the point there is that it's very likely, indeed, research suggests true, that they have market power in particular geographical neighborhoods, but absolutely not in others. So you can't look at it on a nationally average basis. You have to look at particular geographical areas.
I'm curious at this point, actually. Any data on where is it, like, do they have like outsized investments in New York?
Atlanta is a great example. So there's a good book written by a planning professor called Dan Immergluck about Atlanta, and he talks about Atlanta is kind of an asset manager strike zone for housing investment. But there are others as well. Phoenix, Seattle, Las Vegas, and various others. But Atlanta is probably the best example. And there's been lots of academic research that's been done there.
Is it fair to say Australia plays like a huge role in providing capital for infrastructure projects like these, or...
So Australia plays a significant role in the historical story of asset manager investment in infrastructure, not so much in housing, but in infrastructure, things like energy infrastructure, transportation infrastructure. And it plays that role for two reasons. The first is that it was one of the first places, alongside various European countries like the UK, it was one of the first places where large amounts of infrastructure that had previously been owned by governments became available for investment by private sector actors, including asset managers. So that's the first reason. The second one is that one of the first main institutional investors in infrastructure among asset managers was the Australian firm Macquarie, which became a significant investor in and owner of infrastructures, not just in Australia itself, but actually around the world, including in North America, including in South America, including in Europe. So where I come from in the UK, for example, for more than two decades now, Macquarie has been a major owner of infrastructures across the board when it comes to infrastructure, particularly in water and wastewater and energy infrastructures. So yeah, Australia plays a significant role in this history.
In terms of scale, I mean, till now, I think we've touched on North America, Europe, Australia. So I'm guessing, like, again, in my mind, it was mostly like these companies mostly operate in the US. I don't know, maybe I'm just biased, US biased. So I felt like they were mostly operating in the US. And also, I feel like most of the money is probably going to be made in the US. At least that's what I think. I don't know.
Yeah.
So on the scale side, like, managers slash firms mostly operate in US, or is it like US Europe, or is it like North America Europe, or is it mostly the Western world? And also, maybe you can drill down further in, like, for infrastructure investment, is it mostly in the in North America? Too related there, but
yeah, good questions. So there are kind of, when it comes to the geographical question, as you put it there, there are three kind of ways to think about it. There's where's the money coming from that's being invested, and that story is quite a simple one. So it's historically, most of it came from North America and Europe because most of it was pension wealth, retirement savings, and you know, per capita retirement savings have long been far higher in Europe, and in particular North America, than elsewhere in the world. But of course, as I said earlier, as you've got more sovereign wealth funds contributing to these funds, in particular sovereign wealth funds from the Middle East, that historic emphasis on capital from North American Europe has become somewhat diluted. But it's still predominantly a North American Europe story, and predominantly a North America story that the money's coming from. So that's the first question. Second question is, where are the asset managers who pull together that capital and undertake the investment through their funds? Where are they based? That's largely a North America and Europe story. Again, largely a North America story. So the big asset managers in the world are largely based in the US. That's where BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Fidelity are all headquartered. There are some that are European based, and there are even some like Macquarie that are Southeast Asia or Australasia based. But again, it's predominantly North American asset managers that are dominant. The third question that's worth thinking about is where the money is being invested. Now, my answer to, I can give a better answer to that when it comes specifically to real estate and infrastructure assets than publicly listed securities. But the publicly listed securities story is pretty obvious, right? Which is to say that most advanced financial markets, equity markets, bond markets, are in the global north. They're in North America. They're in Europe. So by its very definition, that means that most asset management investment in mainstream asset classes is being pumped into North America and Europe. On real estate and infrastructure is an interesting story. So, real estate has let's lump them together, real estate and infrastructure. Traditionally, it's been mainly a global north story, mainly because those are the markets where, that the asset managers knew best and know best because that's where they're located. And secondly, there have been plentiful opportunities for investment historically in real estate, both commercial and residential, and infrastructure across the global north, as more and more assets have been privatized, as more and more, as governments increasingly look to the private sector to undertake new investment in things like renewable energy infrastructures and so on. There's been loads of opportunities to invest. But as competition has grown amongst asset managers, for those investments, what I would say is that the past decade and a half or so, you've seen those asset managers based in the West increasingly look to other parts of the world for potential opportunities for investment as well. So increasingly, we are also seeing asset managers based in the global north putting money into real estate and infrastructure in the global south, so in South America, in India, in various parts of Africa, to a lesser extent in Africa, but particularly in South America and India and other parts of Southeast and other parts of Southeast Asia. And one of the reasons they've been, as I said, one of the reasons they've done that is increasing competition in their traditional geographic markets. But they've also done it because governments, but also non-governmental organizations, have been increasingly willing to mitigate some of the risks that they have traditionally seen to be associated with investment in the global south. So traditionally there was a reluctance among, say, US asset managers to put much money into various global south markets because they thought, well, there's significant political risks here, for example, and we're a bit wary of that. But increasingly governments and things like development finance institutions have been willing to absorb some of those risks as a way to kind of call forth investment from those private sector asset managers. So today, Global North asset managers are major investors in assets like farmland, in assets like toll roads, in assets like solar and wind farms, all across South America and India and parts of Southeast Asia and increasingly in Africa as well. And I would imagine that that's where the strongest growth in future investment in infrastructure and real estate by asset managers is going to be concentrated, because I think that's where, you know, that's where most of the opportunities are going to be based. By all expectations, by all estimates, the largest amount of future infrastructure investment is going to occur in the global south, not in the global north.
So a few comments here. So first of all, so in that case, it's not uncommon at all where, let's say, a US asset manager will own like a lot of land, a lot of real estate, maybe, let's say, in some remote area of Spain or Portugal. Like, that should not be uncommon at all. Is that fair?
No, definitely not.
Understood. Also, on the... just to be clear on the, when we speak about infrastructure and housing, yeah. So by, and when we when we're talking about, let's say, these investors are investing in housing and infrastructure projects. So just to be clear, in the sense, when infrastructure projects, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, solar projects or renewable energy projects. I'm also thinking about maybe roads, I think, will be done by governments. So I don't think that is included. By housing, I mean, I'm thinking of just like housing, like, you know, houses or apartment complexes. Is that, am I getting the infrastructure and housing what I'm?
Yeah. So on the housing front, there's, I would include in that category, and certainly asset managers include in what they invest in, sort of what in the US is called multifamily housing, so which is essentially apartment blocks, but also single family housing, so detached housing, care homes, student accommodation is a very significant area of investment for asset management firms, but also even mobile home communities in the US have become a very significant area of investment for asset managers. So mobile home communities like trailer parks. Yeah. Okay.
I've seen those in Netflix or TV show, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's how, on the infrastructure side, the biggest one is energy infrastructure. So solar and wind farms is part of that, but also gas pipelines, natural gas storage facilities, electricity grids. So the wires that distribute electricity around the country. So lots of different energy infrastructures. What's often called social infrastructure, which means things like schools and hospitals and prisons, transportation infrastructure, and also telecommunications infrastructure. So fiber networks, data centers, mobile telephony, masts, reception masts. So any of the basically any of the infrastructure that is essential to the delivery of basic utility services that households depend upon, is the way I would put it. And you just before handing back to you, you made an important point when you say roads, that will be government's responsibility. Well, yes and no. So roads will normally be owned by governments, but governments will often outsource the kind of the control of those roads, whether they're toll roads or not, under long-term concessions of, say, 70 or 80 years, under which model the private concessionaire, which is very often an asset management firm, is eligible to receive all the revenues associated with the operation of that road. And so the asset manager is not always actually owning the asset legally, but it is often owning it effectively where it's a very, very long-term concession. And what I mean by that is that the concession grants them financial rights that are tantamount to ownership. That the nature of the cost and the nature of the revenues are exactly as they would be under an ownership model.
Okay. Like, I felt like one thing common between all of the projects that you mentioned for infrastructure, where all of them were very CapEx heavy, like sectors, like,
yep.
Is it because they are CapEx heavy that these funds are able to, is there a relationship there or?
Yeah, 100%. So absolutely, that's true. How thinking about the best way to answer this question. So you and I'm sure many of your listeners will be well aware of the concept of neoliberalism, and to me, neoliberalism means lots of different things, but perhaps above all, it means this kind of development of recent decades where governments across the world have effectively kind of persuaded themselves that it's not government's role to invest in or own lots of assets of different kinds, and therefore privatization has become one of the main most visible and widespread political economic phenomena of recent decades. To me, that's a big part of what neoliberalism is. So, as I say, governments have decided, come to the view, you can use whatever words you want, that it's not government's responsibility either to continue to control lots of legacy infrastructure that they historically did own and control. And not just infrastructure, but housing as well. You can think of public housing. But not only should they not own a lot of that legacy infrastructure, neither should it be governments that invest in financing, building and controlling new infrastructures like classically renewable energy infrastructures. And so they've essentially decided that is the business of the private sector, suitably regulated by government. And we can, if necessary, we can talk about regulation later. But that's the kind of neoliberal consensus, is that major asset infrastructure, investment and ownership is a private sector thing. Well, if you look today at the private sector around the world and you ask, well, who and where in the private sector has access to significant amounts of surplus capital to undertake that type of investment? Well, pretty quickly you land on asset managers, because they're the ones that have access to 100 trillion or whatever the figure is of surplus capital. And so increasingly governments, because of this kind of ideological leap of faith away from the idea that government should be doing these things, because they've decided this is the private sector, then pretty quickly they end up with asset managers. And therefore, not only are asset managers typically not seen by governments as part of the problem, which is kind of how I typically see them, they're seen as part of the solution. And so, and that has put asset managers in a very significant and powerful position, because when governments around the world think about things like the climate crisis and the related infrastructure investment needs, and they think about the housing crisis and the related housing investment needs, pretty quickly they think, well, asset managers are part of the answer, because both of these challenges require lots of investment, and asset managers are the ones that have capital to invest.
So, so first of all, I do not know. I have not lived in a world where asset managers might be involved in, let's say, roads or electric grids.
You probably do, but without realizing it. That's why I was. So, I'll give you an example. Macquarie, for example, just one asset manager, it owns or controls infrastructures on which more than 100 million people rely every day to go about their everyday lives, whether that's in Australia or the UK or India or Brazil or Korea or the US. So, you say you haven't lived in that world, but I bet you have.
I think I have not, I'm not sure, because my knowledge on this is limited, in the sense that in India there is this company called Reliance. It's a huge energy company. I know that they provide petroleum services, but I'm not sure if they provide electric grid services as well. I'm not really sure. My point being, actually I'm more sympathetic to the view of private corporations. Again, this is prefacing the statement that I have not lived in that world where private corporations might control the commanding heights or things like electricity and maybe I'm not able to think of another example, but I'm more sympathetic to that, because just on the example of roads, right? So I live in India. And the roads here are very bad. The roads here are horrible. Even electricity, right? I'm living in Bangalore. And Bangalore... Sure, we can wrap up in. No problem. So one is roads. Another is electricity. I live in Bangalore. And Bangalore is like the IT capital of India. I can parallelize that to Silicon Valley of India, you can say. So even in Bangalore, it is not uncommon to have power cuts. not on an everyday basis, but I feel like if you're the IT capital of India, the least we can do is have 24 hours of electricity every day. As a matter of fact, I had electricity cut yesterday for, I think, about 2-3 hours in the night.
Yep.
So it is that bad. So I am actually, and I don't feel like governments perform the roles, at least here, very effectively in terms of like roads and electricity per se. So that's why I'm sympathetic to that view.
I totally understand that.
Again, I want to say that I want to be clear that I have not lived in that world where private corporations do take care of, let's say, roads or electricity. And I don't know if that is better or worse. It may turn out to be more worse than what I have today.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a really good point. Can I just say a couple of things quickly in response to that? So one is that I think that there is a significant difference between the situation in say the US or the UK on the one hand, and say India or even someone like South Africa on the other. And what I mean by that is that I think in the global north, the fiscal constraints that governments identify are imagined as much as they're real. And simply what I mean by that is that I think that the governments like the US can borrow very, very cheaply, and in fact cheaper than almost any private sector actor can borrow to undertake the type of investment that is increasingly required in areas like infrastructure and housing. Whereas I think the fiscal constraints are very, very real in other parts of the world, particularly in global south. Borrowing costs for governments are much, much higher across poorer countries than they are in rich countries. So I think that it's really important to distinguish between those two. And I think that governments seeing asset managers as the only answer to significant capital investment is more problematic in a sense in the global north, because I think the fiscal constraints are more imagined than real there in the global north. So that's the first thing I say. Second thing I say is, you know, I'm as you will know from our discussion and my work, I'm quite skeptical of private sector control of many types of the assets we've been talking about, of various types of infrastructure and housing, and particularly particularly where the private sector is. We're talking about asset managers for reasons I identified earlier, like the short termism and so on. However, what I am not is a kind of romantic when it comes to public ownership. Like, what I'm not saying is, oh, everything's always better when government owns these assets and manages, because I'm quite aware that not just in India, but in the UK, where I came from, you know, the government was often a terrible steward of energy assets and transport. I mean, British Rail was a disaster. You know, it's not like I'm not kind of a starry-eyed romantic when it comes to public ownership. But what I do think is that at least with public ownership, you have the possibility, if not the inevitability, you have the possibility of outcomes that are not simply shaped by the profit motive and not simply shaped by profit extraction imperatives, such as you get with asset managers. And so I don't think that public ownership necessarily eventuates in better outcomes, by which I mean more socially just outcomes. But I think at least you have the possibility of that with public ownership. And so that was the other thing I wanted to say about that.
I think at this point I want to close here. But before we close, I just wanted to know if there's anything else you want to touch on quick, or anything else you wanted to bring up before we close.
I've really enjoyed the content, but also the style of the questioning. It's been great.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you. Yeah.